In the last lecture, we talked about the relationship between double-strand break repair and downstream pathways that govern cell proliferation, cell death, and cell survival following radiation. It's important to realize that different tumor types respond differently to radiation. Even in vitro, lymphoma and neuroblastoma are really radiation sensitive, whereas melanoma and glioblastoma are relatively radiation resistant. And this same pattern translates into what happens clinically, where there are a number of tumors which really are very radiation sensitive and others which are very radiation resistant. So it's worth asking, how do these different cell types respond to radiation, and what characteristics do they have in common? And also what the relationship is between the cell cycle and radiation responses, because that is one of the hallmark features of radiation exposure. The cells, of course, have been known to exist for a very long period of time, and even in the late 19th century, there was recognition that cells came from cells and that nuclei came from nuclei. In the beginning of the 20th century, Burgundy and Tribondeau put forward a law, if you like, which said that radiation sensitivity was related to cell proliferation. This was based upon the fact that whenever the experiments were done to try and sterilize rams, if they fractionated the radiation, then they managed to get away from the effect of the radiation on the skin while still causing the radiation sterilization. So what they said was that because the testicular cells were turning over more rapidly than the skin cells, then they were more radiation sensitive. So this relationship between DNA repair, the cell cycle, and cell death is of considerable interest in radiation therapy. It really is at the heart of radiation responses by cells, and it determines whether in fact the cells are going to live or die following radiation exposure. The other aspect of it is, of course, that radiation can cause genomic instability and tumor progression. And so it's important to know what this relationship between repair, cell cycle, and proliferation is, and how it relates to loss of reproductive clonogenic cells following radiation exposure. I will pretend that this is a simple kind of relationship. I'd just like to kind of point out that there are molecules involved which we know cross between survival, cell death, growth arrest following radiation exposure, and these are critical in our understanding of these relationships. Let me first talk about intrinsic radiation sensitivity and really how this relates to cell cycle. The outcome of radiation exposure depends not only upon the DNA lesions which are caused and how they're repaired, but also on these signaling pathways that sense danger. And the coordinated response that takes place by the cell really determines whether they're going to live or die following radiation exposure. It also determines how radiation-damaged tissues behave kinetically following exposure, and of course cancer induction. Perhaps the most obvious effect of radiation is seen in terms of death of proliferating cells. And this is a very common feature of radiation exposure. For the most part, radiation-induced death is related to cellular proliferation. So cell proliferation and cell death can be thought of as actually being two sides of the same coin. Fleming identified cells in mitosis at the end of the 19th century, and of course some of these cells were not in mitosis, and therefore he identified two cell cycle phases. In the 1950s, Howard and Pelch noticed that whenever bean root cells incorporated P32 into their DNA, there was a time before they actually underwent cell division, and therefore they postulated there was a gap time, which we call G2, and that there also was another gap time, G1, between M and S, which was required to complete the whole cell cycle. This was later elucidated further by Taylor and others using tritiated thymidine, which is also taken up in the S or synthesis phase into DNA. Nowadays, people tend to use bromodeoxyuridine uptake, and this can be detected using an antibody. So if you kind of look in a very simplistic way at the basic kind of ways in which you can look at cell cycle, you can simply fix cells and stain them and look for the number of cells in mitosis and get mitotic index, or we can look with the labeling index of bromodeoxyuridine uptake or tritiated thymidine uptake. If it's tritiated thymidine that is used, then autoradiography is the way to go. If it's bromodeoxyuridine, you use an antibody to bromodeoxyuridine, which is normally labeled with the fluorescein tag, and this can be examined on the UV microscope. Typically, tritiated thymidine cells are flash labeled, and it's very easy to use the frequency of label mitosis technique to determine the different times that cells spend in the different phases of the cell cycle. However, this is really quite a tedious technique. Nowadays, people tend to use flow cytometry in order to do this. Essentially what happens is that cells are labeled with a dye and a laser is used to excite the dye. The output is collected in photomultiplier tubes. DNA itself can be labeled using propidium iodide, which is a very simple dye. And if you do this kind of technique, then you can see very easily that you get an output which is related to the extent of the DNA or the amount of DNA within the cell. Since the DNA doubles during S phase, then you get a profile of G1, S, G2 and M based upon the amount of fluorescence associated with each individual cell. This technique can be made a little bit more sophisticated by allowing cells to take up bromodeoxyuridine and staining them with a labeled antibody. If one has on the x-axis DNA and on the y-axis bromodeoxyuridine, then initially the green cells will be those in S phase, and with time they will move through to G2M and then into G1 phase. And so one can look at the cell cycle kinetics using these kind of techniques. And in general, what one comes up with is that the S phase for DNA synthesis is about 6 to 8 hours in human cells. The G2 phase is 1 to 2 hours. The M phase is 0.5 to 1 hours. There is a G0 quiescent phase which exists, and a G1 phase, which is of variable length. One can work out the mitotic index and the labeling index on using these formula where the time in mitosis divided by the overall cell cycle time will give you the mitotic index, provided you multiply by a lambda correction factor, which is required to account for the uneven cell numbers that take place due to cell mitosis. All of these estimates are best obtained if the cells are first synchronized in a specific cell cycle phase. The reason for this is that cells in G1 the G1 is particularly variable phase of the cell cycle. You can synchronize cells in some cases by taking floating mitotic cells off adherent cell cultures. Serum deprivation will synchronize cells in G1 phase, whereas drugs like hydroxyurea will synchronize cells at the G1S transition. The importance of the cell cycle has been alluded to already. Cells in different phases of the cell cycle have different radiation sensitivities, and this is a very large effect. So cells in G2N phase are very radiation sensitive. Cells in late phase are much more radiation resistant. I've already referred to the fact that although we're not absolutely sure why this is the case, certainly compacting of the chromatin during mitosis is probably one of the major reasons why this difference exists. One of the hallmark features of radiation exposure of cells is that they undergo cell cycle arrest. This is because cells have checkpoints where they basically proofread their DNA for damage before they are allowed to continue to cycle. This also involves proofreading with the decision being taken as to whether to live or die or not. This decision is a very altruistic type of decision we'll be talking about in a little bit. So this is a very important part of cell cycle arrest, is a very important part of the response to radiation. It ensures faithful chromosome replication, it maintains genomic integrity, but is also very much influenced by cancer mutations. Irradiation causes checkpoint arrest at G1 phase, especially if the cells have a wild-type P53 tumor suppressor gene. They will also cause arrest at the intra-S phase, which is the phase where there's initiation elongation of DNA replication. And this is a P53-independent mechanism. There is G2 arrest, which allows chromatid repair prior to segregation of chromosomes at M phase, chromatids at M phase. And there's also a block in anaphase, which occurs until all the sister chromatids have aligned properly on the spindle. So whenever you irradiate cells and you look at a DNA profile by flow cytometry, you can see that the S phase cells actually decrease in number because cells arrest at G1S. G2M cells accumulate with time after radiation because what happens there is you get G2M arrest taking place. It was found some time ago that if cells are deficient in ATM or P53, then they lose their ability to arrest at G1S, but they will continue to go through G2M arrest. So this indicates the importance of ATM and P53 pathway in the G1S checkpoint. One of the important issues in cell cycle biology is what drives the cells to undergo all of these different arrest pathways, or for that matter, to progress in the first place. Important factors in this process are growth factors or cytokines, and these are involved in activating resting G0 cells and then getting them to enter G1. They drive cells through the G1S phase, and they also allow cells to gain competency to progress into S phase. These growth factors vary with the cell type, but for example for fibroblasts, platelet-derived growth factor, epidermal growth factor, and insulin growth factor are known to be involved. Progression through the other phases of the cell cycle are in fact independent of growth factors. The molecular mechanisms that drive cells through each checkpoint, again, are quite complex. The easiest way to think of them are that the retinoblastoma tumor suppressor gene product is involved in the G1S transition. But there are a series of regulatory factors, which we call cyclins, cyclin-dependent kinases, and regulators of cyclin-dependent kinases, which are important in these transitions. Cyclins actually have no intrinsic enzyme activity. They are synthesized and degraded during each cell cycle phase, and therefore they're important in driving the process forward. They're induced by growth factors, in particular in the G1 phase, and what they do is they bind and activate cyclin-dependent kinases. Cyclin-dependent kinases are serine 3 and 9 kinases that have multiple substrates, such as P53, RB, and many other of the molecules which are involved in moving cells through the cell cycle. These cyclin-dependent kinases have regulatory domains. For example, they have an activating phosphate which has to be added. So whenever they are activated, they autophosphorylate this site. They also have an inhibitory phosphate which has to be removed before they become fully activated. The removal of this inhibitory phosphase involves phosphatases, and in particular CDC25, which exists in various forms, but it's essentially cell cycle phase specific. What happens following DNA damage is molecules called SHIC1 and SHIC2, which are kinases involved in the cell cycle, are activated, and they phosphorylate the CDC25 phosphatases and inactivate them. And because the inhibitory phosphate can't be removed, then the cells will undergo cell cycle arrest. Other important regulatory inhibitors are the cyclin kinase inhibitors, which belong basically to two families. The way these work is that they generally compete with cyclins for the cyclin-dependent kinases. The most important ones are described here. Certainly P21 is important in the G1S transition. It's also involved in the S phase and the G2M. P21 is downstream of P53, and this is one of the major reasons why ATM and P53 is involved in cell cycle arrest after ionizing radiation exposure. The retinoblastoma protein is a critical protein for the transition from G1 to S as well. The way this works is that cyclin D activates cyclin-dependent kinase 4 and 6, cyclin E activates cyclin-dependent kinase 2, and these will both phosphorylate retinoblastoma protein. Now, normally retinoblastoma protein is held or is complex with a factor called E2F. And E2F normally keeps this protein inactive. However, upon phosphorylation, E2F is released, And this is a transcription factor for many of the genes that are required for a cell to pass through the S phase. And therefore, the retinoblastoma protein is essential for cell cycle progression into S phase. And of course, this protein is often mutated in cancer and undergoes constitutive phosphorylation, which again disrupts the G1S transition and means that cells can go through this phase much more easily. So whenever one looks at the cell cycle control mechanisms in general, there is this interaction with cyclins and cyclin-dependent kinase, which are cell cycle phase-specific. This results in phosphorylation of RB, the release of E2F, which is important for S-phase transition. And whenever one gets into the G2 and M phase of the cell cycle, then the cyclin-dependent kinase activation is important in terms of nuclear envelope breakdown, chromosome separation, spindle assembly, and so on. So following radiation exposure, the mechanisms involved here are really fairly complex, needless to say. But we think that some of the most important mechanisms are activations of P53 following double strand break formation and its ongoing repair. This leads to P21. P21 is a cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor, which will then cause G1S arrest. There's another mechanism to get G1S arrest, and this is through activation of SHIC2, which will phosphorylate CDC25A and prevent it from removing the inhibitory phosphate on CDK2. For S-phase arrest, again, SHIC1 appears to be more important in terms of phosphorylating CDC25A. But essentially, it's a very similar kind of process. For G2M arrest, it seems that ATM and ATR are involved. And this leads to SHIC1, SHIC2 being activated, and P53 as well. So there are multiple mechanisms which are involved in interfering with the cyclin-dependent kinase 1 activity. Importantly, if P53 or any other molecule involved in cell cycle arrest is mutated, then you'll end up with genomic instability, as well as more rapid cell cycle progression. And it's clear that cyclins, cyclin-dependent kinases, and their inhibitors, and all of the molecules that are involved in cell cycle progression are frequently mutated of altered expression in cancer. Whenever one thinks of cancer, therefore, one thinks that of this balance, if you like, between repair, proliferation, cell death, and this is important from a radiation perspective, exactly where on this kind of pyramid a cell is, and this will determine really the outcome in terms of life and death decisions. Whenever you think of radiation exposure of cells, there are various possible outcomes of this exposure. The most important from a clinical point of view is that you get decreased clonogenicity. The decreased clonogenicity can occur with our cells going into a quiescent phase or terminally differentiating, undergoing senescence, or actually dying. Radiation is a pathological signal, and therefore it can cause senescence as well as cell death. It doesn't seem to particularly affect the physiological processes of quiescence or terminal differentiation. Radiation-induced senescence is perhaps particularly relevant to radiation fibrosis. They can occur in cells other than fibroblasts. The concept here is that a proliferative progenitor fibroblast, following radiation exposure, will produce P21 and also transforming growth factor beta. Both of these will cause cell cycle arrest, and one ends up with what is essentially a post-mitotic fibroblast. And post-mitotic fibroblasts produce a lot of collagen, a lot of fibrosis, and are generally very much involved in radiation-induced fibrosis as a complication of radiation therapy. Whenever one thinks about radiation-induced cell death, the early radiobiologists showed that most reproductive cells die a mitotic death, also known as mitotic catastrophe. This can take several divisions to actually take place. The number depends upon the radiation dose, but after 2 gray, cells can undergo maybe 2 or 3 cell divisions before they actually die. Cell death is precipitated by chromosome loss, failure of the spindle formation, but the actual death mechanisms that are involved may be multiple. It's certainly interesting to think that cells can go through several divisions before dying. On the other hand, not all of the cells, which are the progeny of the original irradiated cell, necessarily do die. And so one mechanism of recurrence is that these cells have different chromosome abnormalities, and the one that survives is actually the one that has managed to keep hold of most of the chromosome. The early radiobiologists also noted that a few cell types actually die by interphase death, in other words, without dividing. This is a more rapid mechanism than slower mitotic death in general. And so one can divide actually the alternative death style mechanisms up into those that are physiologic and pathologic. The type 1 mechanism is known as autophagy. Type 2 is apoptosis, sorry. Type 2 is autophagy, and the pathologic type of cell death is known as necrosis. Type 1 and 2 are programmed cell death. The death is an active process. The cells actually decide to commit suicide. These death pathways obviously prevent carcinogenesis and mutations, and therefore the decision, the altruistic decision of a cell to commit suicide is extremely important in these pathways. Of course, these death pathways also provide tumor-specific targets for therapeutic intervention. The same death pathways and the mutations that are involved in these pathways, which are cancer-associated, will obviously affect the intrinsic cellular radiation sensitivity. And this is an important kind of concept. What is implied here is that the response to radiation can be seriously impacted by cancer-associated mutations. Programmed cell death is something which is a normal physiologic process, and it's involved in all kinds of normal developmental mechanisms such as morphogenesis, tissue sculpting. It's also involved in the control of cell numbers within the body and in preventing autoimmunity. In general, we think of this process as being immunologically silent, in the sense that although cell death is taking place, the body doesn't recognize it as being a as a pathological process. It's just a normal process. So this is the process whereby you get fingers and guts and even disappearance of sexual organs. Pathologic cell death, on the other hand, is involved in more in terms of an inflammatory type of response leading to wound healing and the development of immunity. The first type of programmed cell death is called apoptosis, and apoptosis is an active cell death process. It's tightly regulated. It's associated with shrinkage of cells in the nucleus. You get nuclear fragmentation with the formation of apoptotic bodies. The membranes bleb, and you can have deletion of single cells in isolation. The molecular hallmarks of apoptosis are caused by induction of endonucleases that cleave DNA between nucleosomes. And this results in the formation of a ladder whenever you put this DNA onto agarose gels. The ladder is caused by the nucleosome 180 to 200 base pair ladder formation. Another way of detecting apoptosis is by a tunnel assay. And the tunnel assay apoptosis is visualized by using terminal deoxynucleotidyl transferases to add labeled nucleotides onto the 3' hydroxyl ends of DNA, which are caused by the action of the endonuclease. So whenever you use this technique following radiation, for example in the gut, you can see individual cells which are undergoing apoptosis. And these tend to be in specific sites within the tissue. They're not distributed all over the tissue. And we consider these cells to have a pro-apoptotic tendency. Autophagy is a rather different process. It's a tightly regulated process, though. And it's really a response to nutrient and growth factor deprivation. It's also seen in physiological processes such as morphogenesis. Essentially what happens is the organelles and other cell components become sequestered in autophagosomes, and these fuse with lysosomes. You get increased endocytosis, membrane blebbing, nuclear condensation. Essentially this is a defensive mechanism. The cell is eating itself as a defensive mechanism to nutrient deprivation, but it can lead to cell death and certainly can be induced by radiation. Necrosis, on the other hand, is a non-physiological process which is associated with loss of membrane integrity, deregulated iron homeostasis. What happens is that the cells essentially swell as water enters and they burst. And this is typically seen in a pathological specimen of a tumor. There's a lot of necrosis. Groups of cells are affected rather than single cells. And if you try and put this DNA onto an agarose gel, you get a random smear being formed. So there's no pattern to the fragmentation. And importantly, this mechanism results in inflammation, which leads to induction of immunity. So one can ask, therefore, what the triggers are for cell death, in particular following radiation. Now, apoptosis is triggered by a number of different mechanisms. These can involve death receptors, for example, some members of the TNF receptor family, tumor necrosis receptor family members. Whenever they bind their ligand, can cause cell death to occur. There is also an intrinsic DNA damage response pathway, which appears to result in apoptosis induction and alterations in mitochondria, which can result in apoptosis as well. Autophagy is generally considered to occur following removal of growth or survival factors or nutrients. Sometimes this is called death by neglect, and if cells don't receive the appropriate stimuli from their environment to survive, they often die, either by autophagy or by apoptosis. And death is, if you like, a default pathway of life, and a very important kind of pathway. Cells that find themselves in the wrong microenvironment will die as a result of death by neglect. Sometimes this is referred to as homelessness or anoecus. There is an important pathway, which is the PI3 kinase ACT-mTOR pathway, which is involved very much in driving cell death and glycolysis. And in controlling the autophagy response. Necrosis, on the other hand, is largely caused by activation of immune cells, release of cytotoxins such as perforins, and these cause holes to be formed in the cell membrane. So as far as radiation is concerned, essentially any of these mechanisms can operate. Mitotic death after radiation can be by any of these molecular mechanisms, in addition to, of course, the chromosome damage which is caused. Interphase death after radiation is generally by rapid apoptosis. It's prominent in lymphocytes, spermatogonia, oligodendrocytes, the salivary gland, and it occurs normally in specific types. And the cells that are most sensitive to radiation generally are considered to have a pro-apoptotic phenotype. One can ask, how does these pathways activated? We know most probably about apoptosis. Apoptosis is mediated by caspases. The morphological and biochemical hallmarks of this process are a result of caspase activation. Caspases are proenzyme type of proteases. So the extrinsic pathway through tumor necrosis factor receptor family members activates caspase 8. The intrinsic pathway through cytochrome C, which leaks from mitochondria to cause cell death, activates procaspase 9. And irrespective of the apoptotic death signal, all caspases activate caspase 3. Caspase 3 is an executioner caspase, one of several, which will cause cell shrinkage by digesting lamin and actin. They will activate DNA fragmentation by removing the inhibitor of caspase-activated DNAs, allowing that DNA to be active. It will block DNA repair by digesting DNA PKCS or another DNA repair molecule called PARP. So in a cartoon fashion, one looks at radiation-induced apoptosis as resulting either from DNA damage, activation of ATM, P53, Bex. And Bex seems to work through causing release of cytochrome C from mitochondria, activation of caspase 9, caspase 3, and so on. Radiation itself can have a direct effect on mitochondria, or it can activate various lipids in cell membranes, leading to mitochondrial release of cytochrome C. On the other hand, the extrinsic pathway involves the TNF receptor family with death domains in their tails, in particular TNFR1, FAS, and TRAIL. And this leads to activation of the caspase 8 pathway. The decision to commit apoptosis is determined by an internal rheostat within the cell. So cells that have pro-apoptotic or anti-apoptotic phenotypes, radiation increases this index, but it really doesn't change the cell from an anti-apoptotic to a pro-apoptotic phenotype. So the question that comes up is, we have cells which vary in their tendency to undergo cell death following radiation. Why is it that all cells don't die by apoptosis after radiation? This is obviously the most sensitive type of mechanism which can be activated following radiation. Well, one of the reasons for this lies with members of the BCL2 family. It's not surprising that this was discovered as a result of oncogene, cancer-associated oncogene. These tend to localize in the outer membrane of the mitochondria. BCL2 itself inhibits apoptosis, whereas BAX, which is from the same family, activates apoptosis. And it's the balance between BAX and BCL2, the pro-apoptotic and anti-apoptotic forces, that control the leakiness of the membrane. The second reason why there is variation in the tendency for cells to die following radiation is that there are survival pathways that affect intrinsic and extrinsic apoptotic and autophagic pathways. These survival pathways are multiple. The most important one are thought to be the phosphoinositokinase 3 pathway and the nuclear factor kappa B pathway. Cancer is associated with mutations in cell death and cell survival pathways. And as I already said, this impacts radiation resistance and makes these things targets for intervention. So whenever one looks at control of these pathways, in addition to just the simple kind of activation of the pathway, one can get also activation of BCL2 or BCL-XL, another inhibitor of apoptosis, and this can counteract the effects of BAX. The activation of the TNF receptor death pathway seems to be through activation of NF-kappa-B, which produce inhibitors of apoptosis, or IAPs, and these inactivate caspases. So for every death mechanism, there is a counter within the cell, and it's the balance of these which is important. So to put this again into another cartoon form, there are survival pathways in cells. Cells can be activated by growth factor cytokines or proliferative signals so as to survive radiation exposure much better. So we've talked about the PI3 kinase and the NF-kappa-B pathway. There's also a RAS-RAF ERK pathway, which is involved in cell proliferation and survival. So the important factors here are what pathway is really determining the status of the cell with respect to its ability to survive radiation exposure. It's clear that these pathways are extremely important because these are contain molecules which are very frequently mutated in cancer, and they also these mutations lead to alterations in radiation sensitivity of the cells. So the intrinsic cellular radiosensitivity really is determined in part by the balance of signals transducing cell death or survival pathways. In general, the clinical response is superior if those cells, if the tumors have pathways which are really already primed for an active form of death, for example, apoptosis. It would be nice to say that one could just look at these pathways and end up with being able to say that this is a radiation sensitive or radiation resistant tumor. The reality is that there are multiple pathways involved, and it's not quite as simple as that, though obviously these molecules are important and do show up in screens for prognostic factors. Normal tissue responses to radiation can also be affected by radiation-induced apoptosis, and the classical example of this is radiation-induced serous cell death, which results in dry mouth following radiation. It's important also to realize that enhancing programmed cell death in a proportion of cells is perhaps a good way in which you can radiosensitize tumors to radiation. Although it doesn't necessarily affect the shape of the clonogenic survival cell survivor curves following radiation exposure, because this really depends upon the response of the surviving cells. So in summary, the pathways that govern cell death and survival also govern radiation resistance and sensitivity. Manipulation of these pathways is a promising way in which you can alter tumor response to radiation. The survival pathways also are important appropriate targets for tumor radiosensitization. And so we see EGFR targeting, NF-kappa-B targeting entering the clinic in combination with radiation. Survival pathways are also an appropriate targets for normal tissue radioprotection. This has gone into the clinic in terms of keratinocyte growth factor, but one hopes that many other agents will get into the clinic as a result of the new pressure to come up with more appropriate radioprotectors.